thanks to you all for being here and to the KITP for organizing this and inviting me. I'm interested in how brains learn to do things, and I'm interested at the level of how synapses connect neurons into circuits that can acquire the ability to make complex motor patterns that are learned, and in this case, the one we study here, vocal learning in songbirds, that are important for social communication. We're going to be talking about the work today is all going to be on these tiny songbirds that are called zebra finches that have really become the lab rat or the lab mouse of the songbird field. What I'm going to do today is give you some background. I know Richard did some of that, so I've actually minimized my background. I'm not going to play any songs unless people really, really want to hear them. I'll give just the briefest background to get everybody awake and up to speed. And then I'm going to talk about a set of data, some from other labs and some from my own. I'm going to pull some threads together and try to weave together a story that leads to some of our work and leads to things I'm thinking about and we're just beginning to do. And so the idea is to really lay out some ideas, and I'm, as Ross Perot once said, I'm all ears. I'd love to have ideas and discuss things afterwards. So there isn't necessarily a complete story with a complete set of answers. There's some, and there's progress, but that's the spirit of the talk that I'm going to try to give. So I'll talk about the role of behavioral variability in learning and how neural circuits in the songbird forebrain can generate that behavioral variability. We'll talk about how that behavioral variability can be modulated by dopaminergic circuits. And the main message is going to be motor variability is generated and modulated by a basal ganglia circuit, and that we're in a position to figure out how that works down to the cellular level. We have some clues, and we think that this will be generalizable to motor learning questions in a variety of vertebrates, including mammals. So, what is song? It's a set of vocalizations, usually relatively complex, more than just the tweet, 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 tweet that you hear birds when they make contact calls. Song is, in songbirds, learned from other birds early in life during a sensitive period in a fashion that's similar to the learning process of speech in humans. It's found in about half of the existing bird species. We're going to talk about the Ossian songbirds, but it appears that vocal learning has evolved at least three times in birds, in hummingbirds, in parrots and parakeets, and in the songbirds. Probably independently, but probably using some of the same pre-existing neural circuitry. That's up for debate. There isn't a lot of evidence at this point. But we're going to talk about the Ossian songbirds. And song is used for evolutionarily important things, for courtship, for territory defense, for things that ultimately affect the survival and the reproduction of the individual. Song is learned, we know, based on behavioral studies in the wild and in the lab for the last 50 or 60 years in several phases. There's an initial phase during which a young songbird listens to and memorizes the song of an adult, often his father, although in other situations it can be a computer playing a song from a speaker. And during that time, the young bird usually doesn't sing. During a later phase, he doesn't need to be with any other birds. In the lab, he can be isolated, although in real life, he often is in the presence of other birds. He practices, and he initially makes poorly formed, highly variable vocalizations that, over the course of weeks to months, with, I think Richard said, and I would come up with the same number, hundreds of thousands of trials, lead to a pretty good copy of the tutor song that he memorized. In some cases, it's an excellent copy. In some cases, it's not so good. Is that poor copying, or is that improvisation? We don't know, but sometimes it can be not so good. Sometimes it can be absolutely excellent. I'm sorry? During practice, there's no feedback from the tutor. The bird can be completely isolated, and in fact, in the wild, sometimes is isolated. in the wild, sometimes there are other birds beating on him when he tries to practice as well. So, but in the lab, he can be completely isolated and do this without any external feedback. He does, however, need to be able to hear himself. If he cannot hear himself practice, the song learning process is completely messed up. After that practice period, the song becomes highly stereotyped, we say crystallized, and that really means two different things. One is that it's stereotyped, and the other is that the bird is less susceptible or less able to learn songs from other tutors. Now, this is sort of the canonical pattern in the 5,000 or so songbird species. There's a fair amount of behavioral variation, probably linked to the ecological niches that these animals occupy. So many temperate songbirds will open up this window of learning each season and learn some of their song repertoire, relearn some of it. So some, for some, it's they go through this once during development, during juvenile development, and at puberty, they're basically fixed, and they're fixed for life. In others, there's an opening of the window seasonally, and in still others, the window stays open pretty much forever. Those of you who've lived in Southern California have heard mockingbirds do car alarms. They'll learn sounds in the environment that they hear over and over again and mimic them. And fully adult birds can do that. That's another issue, but it's sort of interesting that unlike humans who can never learn a language and sound like a native if they learn it after puberty, some of these species can do that. And there may even be some translational benefit to learning what the plasticity mechanisms are in the species that can learn in adulthood. Olivia. Again, it depends a little bit on species. They all generate something. There's some urge to sing. Some species have something like an innate template. So whatever they memorize, if they have nothing to memorize, they have some species typical vocalizations that are kind of sort of recognizable. And other species have a very weak innate template so that they will sound nothing like a normal bird of that species. So there's a fair amount of variability again. That existence of an innate template is actually pretty interesting. We have no idea where that would be in the brain. If they're raised in isolation and can hear during the practicing phase, they do pretty well. A key distinction, though, is if they can't hear, if they're raised deaf, then it's much, much worse than if they're just raised in isolation. It's more variable and different from a species-typical song. Yeah? The tutor can be replaced by others. There are complicated social factors that dictate from which tutor they might learn. It seems to involve something like attention. If you have tutoring by two birds, one that's in the same cage, and they do sort of interact, the older one will peck on the younger one sometimes, that interaction seems to bias the learning toward the one who's in that cage rather than another bird who sings the same number of songs. Okay, so I'm interested in how this works. And we know a lot about the process because of a seminal finding of Fernando Nottebohm 30 years ago now, that there are regions of the songbird brain that stand out. And they're present in songbirds and not present in non-songbirds. So a simple understanding neural cell bodies here in two parasagittal sections at different parasagittal planes highlight nuclei that stick out in songbirds that are not present in non-songbirds, like chickens or pigeons. And neuroanatomical work by a number of people over three decades has gotten us to, well, the simplified version I'm going to show here, but in fact, it's somewhat more detailed. But some of those nuclei that I showed you, the two in the caudal part of the forebrain, HVC and RA, are connected and form a descending motor pathway, shown in red here. And in fact, there are a few neurons that project from RA back to HPC. We have no idea if they do anything, but they're there. But in general, this is a unidirectional pathway. HPC, this nucleus up here, has three classes of neurons. The neurons that project into the motor pathway, a set of local GABAergic interneurons, and neurons that project into this large region here called area X, which was also in the histological slide I showed you in just a minute ago. X projects to a thalamic nucleus called DLM, which projects to a region called LMAN, which projects back to RA. And this pathway, as you've probably all heard, is not essential for producing the adult song. After a bird has learned his song, if you lesion this pathway, this nucleus or this nucleus, song is virtually unchanged. I say virtually because I'll talk about the small changes that occur later in the talk. So this cannot store the circuitry required for generating the learned song. However, lesions of this pathway during the learning phase dramatically disrupt song learning. And so we think of this pathway as essential in some way for the learning process, but its output is to the motor pathway, and it's likely that one of the key actions is to have some impact on the motor pathway to guide the learning of the vocalization. So my lab's interested in a bunch of issues at the cellular level. We're interested in cellular mechanisms of motor pattern generation, presumably occurring in HPC. We're interested in the seasonal modulation of electrophysiological properties of this system. And we're interested in candidate synaptic plasticity mechanisms, of which we think we've just discovered one in nucleus RA. But I'm not going to talk about any of that today, unless anybody wants to in the discussion sections this afternoon. I'm really going to talk about this role of this anterior forebrain pathway, this light blue pathway, in song learning. So there are some working hypotheses out there. An initial one, based on findings from Allison Dope, that there were auditory, highly selective auditory responses in this pathway, is that this pathway might carry auditory feedback or some predicted auditory feedback to guide song learning. More recently, and there's some evidence for that, and there's some evidence that argues that that's not really all that's happening. More recently, there's been some data from Michael Fee's lab and from Michael Brainerd's lab that this pathway provides a directed signal that actually biases certain aspects of song in certain directions, and there's some good evidence for that. And there's a third general class of working hypothesis, and that's that this anterior forebrain pathway generates motor variability. That in fact it generates the trial-to-trial variation in the pathway, presumably by injecting some sort of noisy signal or noise additive signal into the motor pathway. And one hypothesis is that this helps the bird explore auditory space during the learning process, helps him try a bunch of variation and see which ones sound best, sound most like the tutor song. And then in adults, although there's less variability from trial to trial, there is some when the birds are singing alone. And when a bird is singing as an active part of courtship, the song is much less variable. And so there's a dynamic control that can occur over seconds to minutes that reflects different social contexts. And that's something that we've used as a way to get at the mechanism of how this pathway generates variability and how it might inject it into the motor system. Now, these... These are not at all mutually exclusive, and I think there's a possibility that several of these things are going on at once. But today we're going to focus only on this motor variability generation. Okay, so if you take a bird who's learning his song and measure each song and compare it in some way with the tutor song and get a similarity score, and there are lots and lots of different ways to do that. This is the one that Ofer Chernikovsky did, and you plot each song as a dot. During the learning process, you see that there's a huge amount of variability, but that day by day, there's improvement. And there's a reduction in the amount of variability. This is a particularly, I think, insensitive measure for similarity, so there's a huge spread. And this was a particularly fast, accelerated learning process, so in 5 days, the bird's actually making quite a bit of progress from this day to this day. But this shows you the kinds of variation, just how many trials there are, and how variable it can get as the bird gets better and better. The song of a zebra finch. Did you play those songs? Not everybody's heard them. I'll play some examples. I have them right here. The song's about a second long, but the temporal precision is pretty important. Okay, I'll make this song. So these are songs that Allison Dope shared with us. I think they may be the same ones that you played, but they're of a tutor bird and then a young bird on 3 different days during the learning process. And so I'll play the adult, the tutor, and I'll play the son 3 different days, and then I'll play the tutor again. And by the end, you should hear the similarity between the adult, the juvenile who's copied the father's song. I'll try to shut up during the process. Plug your speakers in. Okay, so here's the tutor song. So each repeated segment is about a second long. They often repeat, sing 2 or 3 in a row. But the initial early juvenile song is relatively unstructured and somewhat longer. So this is time actually in hours. This would be daylight hours, nighttime hours, daylight hours, nighttime hours. So each dot, it's not a row, each dot simply represents a song that was sung and at whatever time it was during the day and how similar that song was to the tutor song. So it's this huge cloud, it's a mess. You can't see much. It's the best resolution figure I could get from these authors. Oh, that's the 90th percentile average. It's meaningless, yeah, as far as I'm concerned. It's meant to bring your eye to the progress, but it's the 90th percentile, yeah. It's tens of thousands in some estimates. Yeah. On this scale, they'd be pretty dissimilar. I don't have examples of multiple songs with me. Maybe Richard does. We could probably pull some out together. No? Okay. But they're easily recognizable from different individuals who haven't learned from one another. Okay. So what is the evidence that this behavioral variability depends on the anterior forebrain pathway, the light blue pathway? Well, it came from 2 studies, one in juveniles by Ben Solvecki and Michael Fee and Michael Fee's lab, and the other by Mimi Cao and Michael Brainerd. in some of their work was in collaboration with Allison Dope. So this is an example from juveniles in which in the control birds, before there was any manipulation to the brain, you see now four representations of song. On the x-axis is time. On the y-axis is frequency. It's actually a derivative of frequency, so that what looks like this hill with a shadow is actually a place where there's a lot of power at that time, at that particular frequency. And so you can see, just by eye, that over successive iterations, there's some variability in the structure of this harmonic stack syllable, or this that's supposed to be a whistle syllable. There's a fair amount of trial-to-trial variation. After they inactivate LMAN, the output nucleus of this anterior forebrain pathway, they did it with either TTX or Musimol, you can see there's a substantially greater amount of stereotypy. It's not perfect. And if they measured variability during inactivation and plotted it during variability before inactivation for each bird or each infusion, you can find that there was a reduction in variability when they infused TTX or Musimol, and then no effect when they infused TTX in a neighboring structure or when they infused saline. So this was a really, really nice experiment that I think unequivocally demonstrated that this pathway is at least part of the story in generating the variability. And it recovers after 24 hours, this variability, so that the drugs wash away. They haven't caused some permanent damage. So this was an important finding in juveniles. And they also recorded from a relatively small number of neurons, but in a very convincing way, from a number of neurons in MAN, that there's trial-to-trial variability in the singing. So this is a raster plot over multiple song renditions from juveniles of neurons in MAN. And you can see that the spike timing lined up with the song sung is variable. Now, we could try to measure that, but I'm going to duck that right now. And just you can see that it's not the same from trial to trial. Now, this is also true in, there's a residual variability in adults. And this was work by Cal and Brainerd. And they measured in particular syllables where it was possible to measure, such as these harmonic stacks. They would measure the fundamental frequency and record that over multiple iterations in birds in two different social contexts. US here is when they're singing undirected song, that is song when they're alone, when the bird is alone, or directed song when the bird is with a female and actively courting. And what they found for syllable A and syllable C in this case, where they could measure, get some measure of fundamental frequency, is that the variation of fundamental frequency in the directed condition, in the courtship condition, is less variable than in the undirected condition. So the breadths of these distributions are greater. And that's something that other people have found as well. And what they did is they found that after lesioning, so that's plotted here in the variability in fundamental frequency, plotted as the coefficient of variation over a number of individuals, is to the left of the diagonal. Now, does this, it's a relatively small change, does this matter? Well, we think it does. Sarah Woolley and Allison Dope did a study where they asked whether females will go to a speaker playing directed song or undirected song. And they prefer their mate's directed song over his undirected song. So this is probably important. You can quibble about the design of this experiment, but I think there's good evidence that it does matter to the females. So so I think these small amounts of variation and changes in variation do matter to the females. Questions? Sure. This is the coefficient of variation of fundamental frequency. So it's the standard deviation divided by the mean. In the directed condition, that's during courtship, versus the undirected. Yeah.
So an example of a
not sure which one. This. Oh, yeah? So those studies haven't been done in the way you'd really like to do them, I think, which is systematically very different aspects of the structure, the acoustics, the variation, the order. And I think you should do it not with phonotaxis, that is, moving toward a speaker, but you should do it in a way where the animal can choose what it wants to hear. Because phonotaxis could happen because you not just because you want to be next to something, but because you want to be away from something else. And so when you start talking about to psychologists about how you measure preference, you want the animal to do something active to get a particular thing and have the option to choose, or to do nothing. And we've started to try to do that. It's not easy getting these animals to behave, but ideally you'd like them to peck a key to hear songs and do that. I think there's room for careful and carefully designed experiments there. Yeah. Not in zebra finches. There are people who are trying to measure what the reproductive outcome of males with different song types are in wild populations. But it's also complicated because there are all kinds of extra pair copulations that are, even though the birds are pair bonded for life, there's all kinds of hanky-panky going on. And when you actually try to figure out paternity, it gets complicated. There are people trying with big study sites that have multiple territories, and they can track the genetics of all the birds, but I think we don't know yet. Okay. So even these small changes, though, also depend on MAN, the output of nucleus MAN. So they lesioned MAN and found that there was a complete abolition of this difference between directed and undirected song after the lesion. There's still some variability, but it does not go bigger when the animal is singing alone. So a very, very simplistic working model, just box model of this, is that there's this motor pathway that generates song. The auditory system processes it, evaluates it, sends a feedback signal to help the motor pathway learn. When the evaluation is pretty good, that somehow turns down the amount of noise as the animal gets to be an adult. But that this can still be modulated by social context in some way. And this isn't meant to be overly detailed or overly precise, but it's a sort of working model, conceptual way of thinking about this. And the nice thing about the song system is I think we can get to where the cellular elements are for lots of this. And Richard talked about the auditory processing stages. I'm going to talk mostly about this this noise generator and how it's modulated by social context. So what is it? Well, it's this pathway. And we've learned over the last 10 years or so that this pathway is, in fact, a basal ganglia pathway. It's homologous, in the deep evolutionary sense, to the mammalian basal ganglia thalamocortical loop. So what's the evidence for that? Well, as you know, mammals have cortex, also called pallium, overlying the deep gray matter structures of the forebrain, the striatum, the globus pallidus, and the thalamus. And those are connected in complicated ways, but the simplest canonical circuit here is an excitatory connection from cortex to striatum. Striatal neurons that project to the globus pallidus are GABAergic and inhibitory. Palatal neurons are GABAergic and inhibitory to thalamic neurons, and thalamic neurons are glutamatergic and excitatory and go back to the cortex. So this simple four-stage pathway is thought to underlie the initiation of voluntary motor acts. And the striatum, of course, receives a strong energetic projection from the substantia nigra of the ventral tegmental area. Now, birds don't have cortex per se, but they have everything else. They have cerebellum, not shown here, brainstem, thalamus, striatum and globus pallidus homolog, and then they have something called pallium. It's of the same developmental origin as cortex. It's not laminated in six layers. It doesn't have pyramidal cells. But it has many of the same connections that you would expect of cortex. There are projections from certain regions of here down to the spinal cord as something that might be thought of as a pyramidal tract. There are other regions that receive primary sensory inputs from the thalamus that might be correspond to layer four of somatosensory or visual cortex. And there are basal ganglia loops, just as in mammals. And they more or less follow the same pattern, with one complication. And that is that area X sits right here in the rostral striatum and projects to the thalamus, which is not really the pattern you expect here. So that got us thinking years ago in my lab about how this whole thing works. You know, instead of two stages of basal ganglia, you have apparently one in the songbird. So we started looking at what the cell types are of area X. And Michael Ferris, a really talented graduate student in my lab, finished a few years ago, simply made brain slices of area X from adult zebra finches and asked, what are the cell types there? We know a lot about what cell types are present in mammalian striatum and glabrous pallidus. You know, what are the cell types there? And what he found is that the vast majority of neurons there are medium spiny neurons. They're essentially indistinguishable from mammalian medium spiny striatal neurons. He also found several classes of interneurons that corresponded to striatal neuron classes, a cholinergic type, a fast spiking type, a low threshold spiking class of neuron. And he found one class of neuron that didn't belong, that was spontaneously active at a fairly high rate, even in brain slices, that had other properties that made it look like it might be a palatal neuron. And so work like that over several years has led us to a model where we think, and evidence for this, where HVC and LMAN make projections into the striatal, so these would be cortical-like areas, project to the spiny neurons of area X, which are the vast majority of the neurons, which make glutamatergic synapses, just as corticostriatal connections do. Spiny neurons within area X project to we call them aspiny fast-firing neurons, but they're the palatal class of neurons that project to DLM. And these make GABAergic synapses, and then these cells make GABAergic synapses in the thalamus. And so although we have one structure, we have all the same cell types that you expect from the mammalian striatum and pallidum. They're just intermingled. And we think we have the same, not just the same cell types present, but essentially the same circuitry. And in addition, there's a strong dopaminergic input from the substantia nigra and ventral tegmental area. So it can get a little bit more refined. We now know about a few more connections. There may even be two classes of these palatal neurons. And there may be some excitatory connections from the cortex-like inputs directly to these palatal neurons. But this is fundamentally a basal ganglia circuit. It has all the properties you'd expect of those in mammals. And many of the cellular markers are identical. We think it's really homologous with some slight variation. Birds and mammals have been separated in evolution for 300 million years, but we think it's something fundamentally similar. And I think this crowd might not care as much, but NIH cares that we're studying something that has applicability to mammals. And so I think this puts the generalizability of work on songbirds on a much stronger footing. So this anterior forebrain pathway generates motor variability during learning and to a lesser degree in adulthood. Song variability is regulated by the anterior forebrain pathway in adulthood. The anterior forebrain pathway is a basal ganglia circuit. Dopamine plays a big role in the basal ganglia circuit in mammals and birds. Could it play a role in modulating song variability? So Arthur Lebois, a postdoc in my lab, who's recently gone back to Paris to establish his own lab, recorded from neurons in brain slices and in vivo in area X and applied dopamine, just said, what does it do? And he found that the spontaneous activity of these palatal neurons increases pretty dramatically with dopamine. And that's mediated by a dopamine D1 receptor agonist. It's blocked by a D1 receptor antagonist. It's not mimicked by a D2 receptor agonist, and it's blocked by a D1 receptor antagonist. So These output cells are excited by dopamine acting on D1 receptors. He went to an in vivo preparation. I'm sorry. Yeah, that was in slices, and that was in the presence of a set of blockers of glutamate and GABA receptors. So we believe that this is a direct action on these cells. Yes? At the? We have not. We haven't looked actively at whether there's cholinergic effects on these cells. There are certainly cholinergic neurons there, but based on staining for cholinacetyltransferase. But we've looked and not seen that. It's complicated a little bit because if you do the standard kind of tracing that you would expect to do, you do see some retrogradely labeled neurons in the thalamus if you inject the area X. But there's a risk that those are labeled by fibers of passage because those axons go up to MAN and some of them pass through area X. And so we need a really pure antegrade tracer, and we've had trouble being absolutely confident, but we see no really strong evidence for such a connection. Yeah, it's the bath and probably strong dopamine uptake mechanisms in the slice. We haven't tried to get faster activation. I'm not particularly worried about it. It is slower than you might think in some cases, but yeah. Yeah, and the way to do that would be to, in an in vivo preparation, stimulate the VTA, for example, and we just, I think so, yeah. Okay, so when Arthur moved to an in vivo preparation, he anesthetized adult male zebra finch, in a subset of animals, he was able to get good auditory responses while recording from the area X neurons. So it's not shown here, but time of playback of the bird's own song was at time zero. And this is a smooth parastimulus time histogram. In control conditions, the black trace shows firing evoked by playback of the bird's own song. In the presence of dopamine in area X, that was abolished. And in some cases, he did actually see the firing rate increase, and in some cases less so. There's a pretty good match, although this example doesn't show that increase that we found in vitro. And then this recovers. One of the unsaid things in this field is that the anesthesia doesn't completely preserve auditory responses. And so he didn't do very much with the auditory responses, instead turned to electrical stimulation of HVC. Again, taking advantage of our view that sometimes you want to remove variability in inputs, and we'll use this preparation quite a bit as in the rest of the talk. So he recorded from neurons in area X and gave single shocks to HVC, the cortex-like input. And what he saw was a rapid increase in firing rate, followed by some inhibition. Nothing particularly exciting or interesting there. But that was dramatically reduced by dopamine in area X, and that was in a reversible fashion. So that summary data from a number of cells, this is one set of PSTHs from one neuron across a bunch of neurons. Dopamine blocks the response to HVC stimulation. This is in the palatal output neurons that from area X. Yeah. It's pretty noisy. It's probably 10 or 15. They desensitize, so you have to play them with a fairly long interval. And he interleaved control songs, and so he wasn't able to get very many. And the control songs, yeah. So these neurons, I'm not showing it, but there's evidence from other labs as well as ours that they are selective for the bird's own song, which is often similar to the tutor song. It's another whole issue. Okay, so dopamine reduces the output of the change in output evoked by the area X neurons in the area X neurons by HVC. And this is mediated by D1 receptors, so he can get the same. If he puts an antagonist of D1 receptors and applies dopamine, the reduction caused by dopamine is completely blocked. So he asked then if, and I think the key question is, does this have any effect on behavioral variability? So, but knowing which antagonist to use was really crucial. So I think that sort of cellular level work was important to lay the groundwork for the behavioral experiment. So we measured in harmonic stacks, the lowest harmonic frequency that we could measure. We've also done it by measuring the fundamental frequency, the difference between the frequencies in different harmonics, and found something similar to what Cal and Brainerd had found, that in when the bird is singing alone, there's greater variability in this lower harmonic frequency than when the bird is singing in the presence of a female. But when he infused the dopamine D1 receptor antagonist into area X bilaterally, that prevented the increased precision associated with singing during courtship. So now the bird's alone he's singing with the D1 antagonist, and let me show the summary data, it's a little bit clearer, that when the D1 antagonist is present, the relative variability is higher than when the bird is singing without the drug. So when he's courting, he's still variable with the dopamine receptor blocker. So dopamine is responsible for shifting the bird from being variable to being hyper precise. And blocking the dopamine receptors prevents him from making that jump to hyper precise. And so we think we have a sense of how this works. Dopamine has actions at several places in this area. It decreases the synaptic drive onto the spiny neurons. It increases the firing rate of the output neurons and appears to have some weakening of the GABAergic synaptic connection onto the output neurons. So all of this is going to reduce the flow of information through this pathway, leaving a high degree of output inhibition onto DLM, effectively reducing the output of this pathway, and that we think that's a way in which dopamine could act to reduce behavioral variability. You're looking puzzled. No? Okay. So we've taken the system and used the social context-dependent change in variability that these birds do, that is, the precision that's added during courtship, to probe the mechanisms by which dopamine modulates activity. And we think that's a sort of proxy for the kinds of changes that go on during learning. And we think that by studying dopamine receptor activation and finding that it reduces the HVC effect on this whole pathway, that's a window into finding out how this social context or how other things might control the amount of variability, noise, that's generated by this circuit. We think the D1 receptors mediate this context-dependent change in song variability. We'd like to know if it plays any role in juveniles. We haven't done those experiments yet. There are some technical challenges, but I think they're doable. And what I think this opens up is that we can now get to how does all this work? How does the variability get generated? And how does information flow through this pathway in a sort of detailed cellular way? Question, Livia. Right. So the papers say that area X lesions in juveniles lead the animals to forever variable songs. Their songs never crystallize. That's completely consistent with this. They also say that lesions of area X in adults have no effect. But they did not use the sort of modern high-throughput quantitative analysis that you need to detect this sort of change. And I feel that that's, at this point, sort of a hole in the field. We need to redo those area X lesion experiments in adults. And I think the prediction is that you'll see increased variability. Well, yeah, Scharf and Notenbaum did that, but didn't do a detailed quantitative analysis of the acoustics that would let you detect this. And in their adult area X lesions, they claimed that there was no effect, or very, very little. Jason and Ann. Yes. So the first thing is, I think that result in mammals about the role of cholinergic neurons is somewhat controversial, just about the finding itself. Secondly, we actually have evidence that there's some other neuron that's maybe intervening neuron that's actually consistent with your idea that could be mediating the effects. So we don't really know. We're trying to stain for D1 receptors now. We don't know which neurons they're in. They're probably in multiple neuron classes. So at this point, we just don't know. Another key finding in mammalian striatum is that there are two classes of striatal spiny neurons, the D1 containing and D2 containing cells. And we don't even know if that's true. We don't yet know if that's true in songbirds. So we're trying to catch up. There are lots of ideas that we're trying to take from the mammalian world. I've heard that other people either can't replicate the basic result or can account for it in some different way. And I can't remember the details right now. We can dig this afternoon and I can try to find something. Yeah. Oh. That's the thinking. There's no, I don't know how you. So the song does not drift, which is what you'd expect if it's generating variability. So the idea of maintenance comes about when you talk about experiments like adult deafening. So if you take an adult, in humans it takes months. If you've learned how to speak normally, it takes months for your voice to degrade. In zebra finches, it takes about a month for serious degradation to occur. That is prevented with lesions of MAN, that degradation. But what happens first is song gets more variable in the first few weeks. that variability is generated by the anterior forebrain pathway as well. So we don't, so it seems like it might be doing multiple things. When the animal is deafened, something says, hey, become more active, start exploring. And if you make that lesion during that time, song comes right back to the normal song. If you wait until it's changed a lot and you make that lesion, something else has gone on, and so it's very interesting. It's all mixed up in here, but we just don't know yet. I think that there are bits of evidence that are in favor of that ongoing learning. One other paradigm is if you make a micro lesion in HVC, the bird's song will be initially perturbed, a little bit variable, and he will eventually recover to something very close to the original song. During that period when there's increased variability, that's also dependent on MAN. So a lesion of MAN will bring you right back to the initial song. So somehow, some part of the brain, other parts of the brain can trigger changes in this pathway to cause a greater exploration, greater variability. My guess is that that's exploration. It makes sense. Absolutely testing that hypothesis is pretty hard, though. You can get rid of it, but you're also getting rid of other neurons that project there that could be sending other important factors than just the variability. And so I like that idea, but I think it's hard. I mean, if it's effortful to get rid of variability, then is there what? Then what if you lesion that part of the brain and you get rid of the variability? I guess I don't know what effort is, because turning off that area. Right. So I guess it's possible. I don't know how would you test it? That interpretation. Well, I guess I don't know what effort is. No. And in fact, when he sings alone, he's singing less variable song. He's singing as if he were courting. Right. So it might be, but it, yeah. We get into sort of semantics, I think, about what's effort.
No, I don't think it's semantics. I think effort is usually it takes more energy to gain motor
skills. Yeah, no, that's possible. That's possible. Okay, no, I see your point. Yeah, Mike. So we and others are playing with that kind of reward type feedback for different kinds of things. No results at this point. But I think that may be one way to get at these issues.
Mike. The bridge alone, about Jared's problem with the dark against the tree. With the bridge alone, is there any structure for anything periodically?
We don't know what triggers it on a moment-to-moment basis. There's a circadian rhythm, so I should say there's a light cycle-dependent rhythm. It lights on, they'll sing at higher probability, it'll decay over the first few hours of the day. In birds in the wild, there's a second peak just before dusk, and then pretty much none during the night, except for nightingales. So we don't... What controls that? We have no idea.
I mean, how often does it take? Whenever he's done it,
It's variable. There are some species that the white-crowned sparrows that are around here in the springtime will sit on a bush and every 5 seconds all morning will sing. Yeah, and they'll go eat for a little while and they'll come back and sing every 5 seconds for an hour. It's advertising their territory or something. It can be huge. Yeah. They seem to choose. So zebra finches have just a single song, and they aren't actually territorial. But songbirds that are territorial choose their songs to respond to a territorial intrusion very, very carefully. They know who their neighbors are and which songs they sing, and if they share certain songs, if it's a minor sort of territorial incursion, they'll come over and sing a particular song that's a type that this bird sings. If it's a bigger intrusion, they'll really get aggressive and sing particular songs that he knows that this bird can sing, and more frequently. People do experiments with playing back from speakers different kinds of incursions at different places in the territory, and they can see the response. I don't know all of that literature.
But the demands are similar, like for the
mate. Probably. They're singing in a very intense way, and the variability hasn't been studied as much during male territorial defense, singing to males who are infringing on the territory than to females during courtship. So I think there's room for more stuff, more analysis there. Jason.
So do you want to consider a relation between the
So we haven't recorded that. Neil Hessler has recorded unidentified neurons in the region of the dopaminergic area and finds neurons that increase their firing in directed singing and other neurons that decrease their firing during directed singing. Presumably, the dopamine neurons are the ones that increase their firing, but we don't. Those cells were unidentified in the behaving animal recordings. Eric Jarvis has made microdialysis measurements of dopamine levels in area X with something like 15-minute time resolution, and sees something of an increase in the context of when there's a female present. Consistent with all this idea, but not. We think the dopamine receptor antagonist data from my lab is the strongest evidence that dopamine is causing this change. I wasn't in neuroscience last year. So yeah, I mean, we were trying to make electrochemical measurements of dopamine in area X in behaving animals, and because I think that would give you sub-second temporal resolution. And for technical reasons, we had trouble and we've stopped doing those experiments, but I think they're potentially doable. With other males, there are social hierarchies in a big colony. So they're colonial. They live in a big group. They pair with a female and they go back to their nest at night, but they interact with all the other birds. And exactly what they do with other males, I don't know. Certainly, in a lab situation, a cage of 5 or 6 birds, they'll form a social hierarchy, and it's clear that there's a pecking order among the males. But I don't know what they do in the wild. Okay. So, all right. So how does all this work? What I want to do in the next few minutes. Really, the last section of the talk, it looks like the timing might work out just perfectly, is talk about what we, what is, what are the origins of this variability? How do we think about how this circuit, how these, this, this neural circuit can generate variability? And so what I want to tell you about is what we, how we think about how the circuit passes information. And I'm going to tell it in a way that's not chronological. We've published some of this work. I'm going to tell a story in a slightly different way. So Arthur LeBlois also looked at, you know, there's one other thing before I get into that. The dopamine neurons. While nobody has recorded from dopamine neurons or identified dopamine neurons during behaving situations, the dopamine neurons receive a song-related signal. So although we expected to find a striatonigral projection, we did not find one. But we found a disynaptic connection from area X to a region of the ventral pallidum, and from there to the dopamine regions. And we've recorded in anesthetized animals from identified dopamine neurons and found that they have a song-selective auditory response. And that comes from area X. We can block it by blocking area X synaptic transmission. So the dopamine neurons are in a position to contribute to the evaluation of song. Now that's in anesthetized animals. Maybe it doesn't work like that in behaving animals. But they could well be contributing to something in this domain. So I should have said that earlier. Okay, so how does this anterior forebrain pathway generate variability? To address this, Arthur LeBlois started again with this anesthetized animal preparation, recording extracellularly from single neurons, now in MAN, the output of this pathway, and stimulating in HVC. And I'll show just a little bit of data. Went from one cell where when he stimulated, he could see an increase in firing in MAN. And across multiple trials, the raster plot shows, well, there's a spike that happens with some degree of precision here, and then there's this other burst of firing. It's the latency across a number of neurons is pretty variable. The average PSTH across a bunch of neurons, plus or minus standard error, is quite large. There's a fair amount of variability in this firing. So this is one way of measuring variability sort of through this whole pathway, in the absence of any variability in the input. These are single shock responses. And in fact, we know from Alex Kozhevnikov's work with Michael Fee that during singing, the outputs from area from HVC, that the neurons that project to area X, fire in a pretty precise manner, almost as precisely as the neurons that Richard discovered on the projection output from HVC to RA during singing, which have millisecond level precision. They're almost as precise in their output to area X. So we figured the single shock paradigm to stimulate here would be a way of sort of mimicking the natural condition and introducing zero variability, at least at our stimulating electrode. If you record in DLM, what you find is fewer responses, similar PSTH, but what you find is some trials where there's no response whatsoever. The jitter is fairly high. And so there seems to be, at least at DLM, a substantial amount of trial-to-trial variability. Across cells, the excitation latency is fairly distributed. And the probability of response, of any spike, so across a number of neurons, is low, even with strong simulation strengths in HVC. So many neurons respond on one trial in 10 or one trial in 5. So we think that somewhere between HVC and DLM, there's something generating variability. And by bracketing that, we think we can study at this in vivo level and then in vitro level the circuit that's generating this trial-to-trial variability. Richard.
Which means that we won't have
All of these are significant. So any animal that did not have a PSTH that went above a significance level based on the spontaneous firing rate was excluded as not responding. There weren't very many of them. Sorry? Well, it's not at zero. It's a bin between 0 and 0.1. So there were neurons with probability between 0 and 0.1. If it was actually zero through the whole thing, it wouldn't be in here. And we didn't actually have to exclude very many neurons. So, okay. All right. So, we started at MAN. We found this variability in DLM. What does it look like in area X? Well, area X had a fairly high probability of firing. There were two main patterns of firing. One, after the stimulation, there was a rise in firing rate and then an inhibition. And in other cells, the inhibition seemed to arrive first, which was a surprise to us. But that could, and then was followed by excitation. So how could that work? Well, this could happen. We think all the inputs from HVC, from cortex-like structures, are glutamatergic and excitatory. So the only way to get something like this is if there's an intervening GABAergic interneuron, and the best candidate for those would be the fast-spiking interneurons, which should fire very, very rapidly. Now, we didn't identify them, but we found a class of putative interneurons with a low spontaneous rate that fire at very short latency, and that could, in fact, if they made synapses onto the palatal output neurons, could account for that early inhibition. So if these are the fast spiking neurons, or whichever ones they are, these neurons are present, and they could well account for this rapid inhibition. Yeah? We have not. We've used urethane, which is an anesthetic that preserves, in many cases, the auditory responses. It's something that we should try, or bite the bullet and go to the unanesthetized preparation. There are sleeping bird preparations. There are head fixed preparations that are awake, that are unanesthetized, and we've been pretty reluctant to go to those, but there's value in doing it. So if we don't, somebody else should. We probably will. Okay, so yeah. We have not seen any sort of upstate, downstate oscillations in the cells we've recorded. There's a paper in pigeons anesthetized with, I'm not sure what, with intracellular recording in striatal actually, I'm not sure exactly which neurons they were, that shows something like upstates and downstates. So it may be that birds do have something like this, but we haven't seen anything like it here. Okay, so if this hypothesis is right, that is that an inhibitory interneuron can fire fast and cause a pause in the palatal neuron, then if you were to block GABAergic inhibition in area X, that would predict that should get rid of responses in DLM. I think there's one piece of the puzzle that I haven't made explicit, but it's coming. I'll make it explicit now. DLM neurons receive inputs from these palatal neurons. And they receive a high rate of GABAergic input from a single presynaptic axon that makes a giant set of synapses onto a single DLM neuron. The DLM neurons, and I'll show evidence for this in a moment, fire as a rebound spike upon cessation or pausing of the of this presynaptic firing. So we think that whenever this neuron pauses, that gives a chance to the postsynaptic cell to escape this tonic inhibition and allow rebound firing. So if we're interested in how this pathway sends information through, we're interested in how pauses can be generated. If this is a GABAergic interneuron synapsing onto this cell, it could cause this pause. So Arthur then went on to record from DLM in the thalamus, give single shocks, show responses, and then infuse a GABA-A receptor antagonist, gabazine, into area X. And what he saw, these are two examples. In one case, there's a nice response. In gabazine, everything goes away, but the cell recovered. In the other case, gabazine made everything go away and had no effect on the spontaneous firing rate, and the response recovered. So GABAergic inhibition within area X is essential for the evoked responses in DLM. That's all consistent with this idea that these interneurons are causing these pauses and allowing the DLM neurons to rebound. Now, this is in here for Chuck, because we talked about axon sizes yesterday. We've done some light microscopic and electron microscopic analysis of the axons of the output from area X to DLM. And these are some of the biggest axons I've ever heard of in a small mammal or small warm-blooded animal forebrain. So these can be 4 to 5 microns in diameter. This is gold label from an antegrade injection of tracer into area X to say that this axon in DLM is in fact coming from area X. And if you look at the distribution of light and electron microscopically labeled axons, they're, you know, the median diameter is 2.5 to 3 microns, which I think is quite large and suggestive of very, very fast conduction times. Now, I said that these axons make large synaptic boutons, large synaptic connections onto DLM neurons. Abby Pearson, a graduate student in the lab, and then Arthur, when he was a postdoc, were able to record extracellularly in DLM, and in a small number of cases, I think we have a total of 14 now, was able to record simultaneously action potentials from the postsynaptic thalamic neuron and the presynaptic bouton. So those recordings look something like this. These are glass electrode recordings, presumably near the soma and near the large presynaptic ending. And what you see is large spikes, well isolated, next to small spikes, not quite as well isolated, but simultaneously recorded. Now, if those are in fact synaptically connected, then you ought to see some correlation in the activity. And what Abby noticed and studied quantitatively there seems to be a pause or a slowing of the small spike firing rate prior to the big spike firing. And she did a bunch of work that's all published that identified the small spike as the presynaptic axon and the large spike as the postsynaptic soma. And when she did the spike-triggered average, times zero representing the time of the large spike, the postsynaptic neuron, what you see is there's a pause or a reduction in firing rate about 20 milliseconds before that spike that we think allows the postsynaptic cell to rebound. And in vitro whole cell recordings, we can mimic the same process. So one working model for how variability is generated is that it depends on when the input comes. The palatal neurons have a very regular baseline firing rate. If the inhibition to those neurons comes early in the interspike interval, that inhibition will have relatively, will be a short inhibition, will have relatively little effect on this, will not inhibit, will not prevent the next spike. That next spike will go down to DLM and keep the cell inhibited, and there will be no response. If that spike comes later in the palatal interspike interval, that inhibition could prevent or delay this spike, causing a pause in the palatal output and allowing the DLM neuron to rebound. If that's true, then exactly when this input arrives should have an impact on the firing probability. And we haven't yet, but we would like to design experiments to stimulate in a fashion that's triggered by the particular spike on the presynaptic cell, and be able to test this in a direct way rather than try to do it in a post hoc manner. But that's a prediction that we would make based on this firing, based on this model. What we did do is build a simple compartmental model of a DLM neuron with a rebound, and give it presynaptic spike trains that we recorded with a big synaptic input based on the voltage clamp data that we have. And we found that if we simply played evoked HVC spikes into this cell, we could get a probability of response from the model and a latency distribution that more or less sort of approximate the probability, the response probability and the excitation latency that we recorded in actual neurons. So we're at this beginning phase of trying to understand how, what is variability? It's, does the DLM neuron spike or not? Is it when it spikes? We're starting to go back to do careful analysis of some of these things. But for the question of whether the DLM neuron can fire, the issue is what causes the area X neuron to pause. And that, we think, is going to be some complex interaction between when the input arrives versus when the presynaptic cell, the area X neuron, where it is in its interspike interval. And so we're approaching these ideas at the cellular level about how this circuit can generate the variability. It's going to depend also on how much an individual interneuron can spike and how much that will cause the pausing in the area X neuron. So we have a lot more specific cellular things to measure, but the outlines of a working model for how you can generate variability are becoming clear. And so what we think is that this pathway right here and right here generates and maybe amplifies variability that gets transmitted through here, can get modulated here and maybe elsewhere, and that is how this circuit generates and injects motor variability into the motor pathway.
Are there also big axons in the LMR pathway?
Not that we've seen. We didn't look at those in particular. We looked at when we injected tracer here, we looked at the collaterals of these axons going back to area X, and they're small. They're a micron or less in diameter.
If you're trying to keep time with that whole loop, what big axon is
that to the LMR? Yeah, you're right. We can look for those. We don't know. Sure.
I don't think it's totally on others, but variability is a useful thing about where you have any standard or consensus in the ground is there. But it doesn't have to be quite very obvious, or
So we're interested in how it actually happens. But so I haven't tried taking some randomly connected network and seeing it. I guess what you'd want to do is compare the exact statistics. We haven't tried that. There have been... So, I mean, this is why I'm here, because I haven't, this is not my area of expertise, and I would love to have more discussion about this. I mean, because there may be completely trivial stuff that I'm not aware of, that I haven't thought about. I guess I want to be constrained in my thinking as much as possible at what the actual circuitry is. We know, we're starting to know a fair amount about that, but if this is something that falls out of any random model, then that's...
Okay.
Right. So we know something about how this, what happens in RA. So RA has some GABAergic interneurons, but its main class of neurons is projection neurons. Those projection neurons receive convergent inputs from HVC and from MAN. Both of those inputs are glutamatergic. These are normal. The HVC inputs have AMPA and NMDA receptors. These, Rich Mooney showed, and we've confirmed, use only NMDA receptors. Only excitatory, but their postsynaptic cells have only NMDA receptors at those synapses. That alone, that is another complication, and interesting. Exactly what it does, we don't know. Yeah.
So that it will walk through the state to get the electron. And so that's overall the model that you start off.
what you have to do is have some variability to train up the circuits to do the learning so that they can recalibrate what the errors are or what the error signal is. And so this is generating very precise kinds of variability that around the zones you have train up the
Well, so I think we don't know. I think it's clear that it's generating some variability. Whether the embed, and it's also clear, and I mentioned this earlier, that it clearly is in some cases doing some biasing of the song. So if you remove it, in certain learning paradigms, there can be a shift of fundamental frequency slightly or things like that. So there's some. So it's not just a noise generator. There's room for it doing something else. But it's possible that the feedback during normal song learning over days to weeks is really coming from somewhere else. That's also possible. So I think we just don't know. So not a lot is known about the time course of improvement. At least with the metrics we have, it appears that there's wildly random fluctuations over even a whole day, and there's maybe a little improvement over a day, but some of that's lost overnight. And not immediately corrected. So it's not clear that it's integrating over the last hour to cause improvements. I'm not sure whether you asked this. The other aspect of it is some of this noise or variability generation can be regulated very rapidly. So you put a female in, and within seconds, the song's precise. So that's a rapid thing that could be independent, right? It could be this. The dopamine input. So if you're asking about what happens during learning, how does the right. It suggests something else, and yet we don't have evidence for anything else. Yeah, I don't know who was next. Livia. So our experiments were done in adults, yes. And so doing some of them in juveniles is on the list, absolutely. So yes, in two contexts. Seasonally, in the springtime, the day loops get longer. That causes the testes to grow. That causes an increase in circulating testosterone. That causes the song system to grow. HVC doubles in volume. RA doubles in volume. HVC gets new neurons that send axons to RA and make new synapses. And there are electrophysiological changes in RA, some of which we've described. This seems to require a complex interaction of androgen and estrogen receptors here and androgen receptors there. So we know some of that. And the song, well, that's in a species that goes from not singing much to singing a lot. And their singing quality improves over a few weeks during that period. In zebra finches, during learning, we know that if you give them a high dose of testosterone, that will prematurely crystallize their song. Premature. We don't know how that happens, but we have unpublished data that we found a form of synaptic plasticity here that is there in juveniles and not there in adults and can be prematurely eliminated by testosterone treatment that prematurely crystallizes the song. We don't know how that happens, but it's in hormonal effects are in the mix here. Mike.
Yeah. So PLM.
It's the sole input that we know of.
And is DLM, is there the equivalent of reticular nucleus compounds that you sound like?
We think so.
Outside population, GABAergic population.
there's a small cluster of GABAergic neurons just rostral to DLM near the border of the thalamus that we think might be serve the purpose of the reticular nucleus. We've seen only retrograde tracing. We haven't done any anterograde tracing. We haven't done any physiology. That's a question that comes up. It's a great question. That's our best answer. We know so little about this. But if you look at GABA synapses onto DLM, so we've done EM level analysis of GABA immunolabeled terminals, and on the cell body, most of the cell body is dominated by these large boutons from Arix. There are some small GABAergic terminals else on the dendrites, but they're relatively sparse.
But DLM has a strong key current, another way.
Yes. Just like thalamic neurons in mammals. Yeah. Jason, sorry.
The spinal cord neurons, are they connected to each other?
We don't know.
So I'm just wondering about.
Probably.
I'm just wondering about your experiment to shut together, hanging together, everything. Why is something there when it's not quite all over there?
I didn't say. I said they were unidentified neurons. But the fast spiking neurons would be the most likely to be excited quickly. That could contribute. Yeah. So we don't know. I said there are fast spiking neurons there. And if they were the ones, those unidentified interneurons, then that would be most consistent. But that's all. Yeah. So we have recorded in DLM in slices from juveniles, and they do show the similar properties of fast rebound. The one thing that we found in juveniles was a slightly longer GABAergic synaptic current decay time constant. So, and we haven't looked very, very young, but in the age when they're learning, there's a slightly slower decay of inhibition. So that might change the time course for throughput of information in this region, but we don't know. So we don't know. We've measured in adults, we've measured the GABA reversal potential with perforated patch recording, and it's very, very negative. In many systems, that negative reversal potential is governed by the expression of the potassium chloride cotransporter, KCC2. We're in the process of doing KCC2 staining in DLM through development, and we see it rise pretty early. But we haven't made the quantitative measurements of GABA reversal potential yet to be able to link those. But that's where we'd like to go. We're thinking along those lines. We'd love to know how you get a one-to-one connection at a GABAergic synapse. In all other cases, there's some sort of competition among multiple presynaptic axons that are excitatory, and you know, at the neuromuscular junction, at the climbing fiber input, and so we would predict that something like that must be happening. Well, we don't know. It's probably happening very, very early, though. Okay, sure. So I'm here. So I've said all these things. The anterior forebrain pathway is a basal ganglia circuit with, I think, deep homology to the mammalian circuit, and we think we can maybe generalize some things from what we're learning to mammals. One of its roles is to generate motor variability. Dopamine can regulate this variability, and we think that by studying this circuit, we can make progress toward understanding how the circuit transmits information, generates variability, and maybe it's a trivial thing for any network to generate it, but we'd like to know how this network generates variability. And finally, the people who did this work, most of it was done by Arthur Lebrun, who's here, and Agnes Bodor did the EM, Sam Gale and Ben Wendell also contributed. So, and we've had funding from NIH and NSF and these guys. So, thank you. So we think about that a lot, and the one way of thinking about this is, I don't have slides in the system here to show this, but if, let me go back to this, if, so it's not shown on here, but area X projects to the ventral pallidum, and the ventral pallidum projects to the dopamine neurons. And we've recorded, identified dopamine neurons that they respond with an increase in firing rate to playback of the bird's own song. If hearing the tutor song is rewarding in some way, then you can imagine that as the bird is practicing, and if he sings a song that sounds like the tutor song, and that signal gets to area X, it's also going to get to the dopamine neurons. So there, that signal is well, would be well placed to signal to wherever these neurons project that the bird has sung a pretty good song. Now, where do they project? Well, the biggest projection is to area X. But dopamine neurons project widely through the forebrain. And so it's possible they could signal to other places, the most interesting places likely to be RA. But we have no evidence that they in fact fire more on better songs during juveniles. But that's one way you can spin a story. I think most of the time when we get, when we do the experiments for directed song, we open the cage, suddenly a female arrives. That's an unpredicted potential reward for the individual. That could well trigger dopamine release. And so that it's in many ways completely consistent with this idea of unpredicted reward, unexpected reward. Is that what you're...
Yeah.
I mean, that's in the context of the experiments we're doing. In real life, I think the same thing could happen, right? If courtship is rewarding or leads to rewarding activities, then the dopamine might rise in that context and cause a directed song. We've thought about a lot of those experiments and are partway into doing that. The electrochemical measurements of dopamine would be crucial for that, and we've had technical problems, but we've stopped them now. But that's how you would get to those. That's what we had movement artifacts that got in the way. It's done in rats and mice, so it should be doable in birds. Yeah, well, it's there. It's big in birds. It helps them balance. It helps them perch and hold on in the wind. Helps them land and fly. We know of no anatomical connections that are direct between the cerebellum and the song system, but they come awfully close. we've looked pretty hard for them. And if you inject a retrograde tracer into ELM, you find deep cerebellar nuclei labeled. And if you do the anterograde tracing, you find connections right around but not into DLM. And those regions project near but not exactly in MAN. There's the possibility of some sort of input there. We've tried really crude lesion studies, and they haven't been very informative. But
not of the HUC group.
No. Well, that wouldn't fit with the general vertebrate plan. The vertebrate plan always has the output of deep cerebellar nuclear neurons going to the thalamus or the brainstem. So that would violate all kinds of basic homologies.
What's the allure of the female? Is it hormonal? Is it visual? Flash a picture of a female? Change the variability?
It's likely to be visual, but I don't know of. People haven't looked in enough detail. Certainly, simply putting a mirror will sometimes get the birds to sing more. undirected, in fact, but I think there's room for doing more there. Do you have a sense about that? Well, no, about. I'm not asking if you sing in front of the mirror. No, but if what the signal is that makes a male detect a female. I mean, it's likely visual, but it may not be. You might need more than just a static picture. You might need movement. Okay. So there may be auditory as well. Okay. Okay.